You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. We now bring you Jesus, the promised Messiah of Judaism, with Roy Shoman.
Hi, this is Roy Shoman, and welcome again to our show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic faith, or seen the other way around, the fulfillment, the completion of all of the promise and potential of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. This show, until very recently, I had the title, Salvation is from the Jews, a title that on the one hand had going for it the fact that it was a direct quote by Jesus himself, or of Jesus himself, in John chapter 4, verse 22, when he meets a Samaritan woman at the well. He says at one point, salvation is from the Jews. So I thought it made a kind of neat title for that reason, also because it was the title of my first book, which I called Salvation is from the Jews, for the same reason. But it had the slight danger that somebody who didn't see it in the context might think it meant that you had to be Jewish to be saved, which of course would be a horrible misunderstanding. So we changed the title to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, again to try to show the continuity, the fact that Judaism and the Catholic Church are not two separate religions. But really, it's one story that consists of two phases. The first phase, to prepare for the incarnation of the Son of God as a man. And the second phase, to propagate the salvation that he brought throughout the whole world, throughout all peoples, through Christianity and through the Catholic Church and its sacraments. So it's really, Judaism is, you can think of it as pre-Messianic Christianity, and Christianity is post-Messianic Judaism. And so to try to capture that, at least for now, the title is Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, because Jesus was the Promised Messiah of Judaism, the fulfillment of Judaism, and the turning point which turned Judaism into the Catholic Church and its sacraments. So it's the same show. I'm the same host. It's a new name. And the shows are, of course, still up on, archived on the website of Radio Maria if you want to listen to past shows, and also on my website, salvationistfromthejews.com. And before I begin the show proper, let me just, make a little note that I will be leading a pilgrimage to Israel, God willing, in April. Everything's been arranged, which will be around Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism. It'll be a Catholic pilgrimage in the sense that we will visit all of the normal Catholic pilgrimage sites hallowed by the events that took place there during Jesus' life, like the institution of the Eucharist and the multiplication of the loaves and fishes and so forth and so on. But we will also visit some Jewish holy sites and some sites that show the typological foreshadowing of Christianity in the Jewish sacrament. So if you're interested in joining me on that pilgrimage, there's information on that also on the homepage of my website, salvationisfromthejews.com. Now, if you're a regular listener to the show, you know that one of my absolutely favorite things to do on the show is to have on a guest who is another grateful recent entrant into the Catholic Church, sometimes from Judaism, sometimes from Protestantism, sometimes from atheism, to tell their witness testimony. And the only problem one has being born and raised a faithful Christian or Catholic is that you have nothing to compare it to. You have nothing to contrast it to. And very often God has not had to work miraculously in your life to bring you where you are, although often he does anyway. But in the case of people who come in from radically different backgrounds, very typically God is sort of forced to show his hand a little bit more dramatically, and therefore these stories very often are very faith-building because they actually, God was forced to use miracles or certainly extraordinary experiences of consciousness and so forth in order to break through the wall of disbelief. So in that light, I have invited on the show a very new entrant into the Catholic Church who came from an atheist background. I won't presume to begin to tell her story, but I think that would be more appropriate for her to do. So are you there, Sally?
I'm here, yes.
The reason I know about Sally is that she wrote her witness testimony in a very, very beautiful book. And the proof that it is an extraordinary book is that it was accepted for publication by Ignatius Press, which is always a miracle. And it's not out yet, but it will be. And it's a very extraordinary book, frankly, both in the story it tells and also in the spirit in which it is written and in the spirit in which the story is told and the language in which the story is told, because I'm babbling, but Sally also is a quite accomplished poetess, and I think that kind of comes across in her description of her journey. Anyway, yeah. Back to you.
Okay, well, you know, it's true, I was an atheist, and in the sense that I was really raised in a very atheist family. And I think, you know, in the secular world these days, people are often, well, especially in Britain, where I'm from, people are brought up outside of faith. But that's not the same as being brought up as an atheist, because I think a lot of people in Britain are brought up outside of faith, but they have a kind of a wishy-washy notion that if they, you know, if they need God or they need a God, you know, they're there somewhere at some point, or God is what I can make him, or there is something out there. And I was brought up in a very rigorous, almost sort of intellectual atheism where, you know, my father in particular, you know, really taught us that religion was evil and bogus. You know, some of his allegations, you know, about stupidity in religion, you know, they're self-evident in the world. And as a child, I was brought up, you know, to know Karl Marx and to, I quickly read Christopher Hitchens, et cetera, et cetera. So I really was an atheist. And I was inquiring about religion in the sense that, I sensed from a very early age that if a person was religious, then life was easier. But no matter how tough things got as a young woman, and when I was a psychiatric nurse in London, no matter how low I became when I lost my father, no matter how black, and even at times when I thought, you know, if only I could believe in God, it never happened. You know, it really didn't. I mean, and it was almost... you know, it's almost like the door was left open for God to a certain extent, but I think my defenses were so very high. And I also wonder whether God was almost saving himself for a particular point in my life. I think I had to have lots of years as an atheist to really look at what the world looks like without God. Because, you know, something that converts will always tell you is that suffering without God is very different from suffering with God. There's just no question. You know, it's such a misconception that my family have that they think that religious people believe that suffering is taken away with God. And that's just not true. You still suffer, but the suffering is completely transformed. It has meaning, it has beauty, and it has dignity. It's something that you do with Christ. It's very different. So yes, kind of the atheist to the believer has been an enormous, enormous grace for me.
Well, let me ask you a question, but I'm also inviting you to tell me in the future, please shut up, Roy, and don't interrupt me with questions. So it's up to you. But for the moment, I'll try this one, which is just give us a little bit of a picture of what the picture of Christians and people who believed in Christianity was when you were growing up. I mean, did you think they were like stupid, naive, well-meaning fools or what?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially because I'm from Britain, where the Anglican Church was, I'm not sure about now, but it was the kind of main church as I was growing up. And Anglicans, you know, in my house were seen largely as grinning idiots, you know, just well-meaning but very vapid and very intellectually void. The Catholic Church, I hardly dare tell you, you know, is really, you know,
just like Monty Python, you know, the Inquisition sketch or something.
Yeah, well, worse, because, you know, evil. I mean, I know my brother married a Catholic actually a long time ago, and when my father was still alive, and when she had her children baptized Catholic, my father was really angry, and I was really angry, and we felt that it was a faith that had unconscionable beliefs. I mean, wicked beliefs, really. And, you know, it's, you know, as recently as 2010, you know, before I converted, that was the year I converted, I believed that, you know, the church's writings on homosexuality and contraception and abortion were evil. I really did. And again, I think that gives a person another perspective, because when I talk to a person who's pro-choice, who believes in abortion, who's otherwise a good person, you know, a sound moral person, I don't perhaps judge them as perhaps others might, because I remember very clearly how I thought, you know, and I know that I wasn't rotten. I was misguided. I was very misguided. And I think that there are, you know, even politicians out there who they think that they're believing and doing the right thing for women, especially male politicians. I think that they think that they're doing women a favor, and they can't see that they're not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting how it's good. You know, part of the reason I wrote the book so soon, because I did wonder whether to write it. I wanted to be at that point in my conversion, because I still consider myself, of course, converting, as we all are. I wanted to be at that point where I could look back and remember things vividly, how I felt as an atheist and how I thought, and also have the excitement and the conviction of being a Catholic at the same time. Because I don't know in 10 years' time or 20 years' time whether I'll forget what being an atheist was like.
Well, that's a good reason to tell your witness testimony frequently, because it keeps it fresh in your mind.
Yeah.
I'm say that, not literally joking. I find it's very... I'm always very grateful when I give my witness testimony, because it brings back the reality of the world that I was in, you know, before my conversion, which actually reminds me of I don't want to say one of my favorite quotes from your book, but certainly a quote that stuck in my memory, which I don't know what you were, perhaps late 20s, and the quote is, "This is hell, I'm in hell."
Mm. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, because this goes back to, you know, what you were saying. And I think one of the frustrations I have dealing with faithful cradle Catholics who are always faithful is the way they feel like it doesn't really matter. You know, you can be happy this way, you can be happy that way. And it really does matter. And you really can't be happy without God, and you can't. You, as you mentioned already, you have no place to go with suffering. You have no place to go with the frustrations of life and the failures of life and so forth. If you have no bigger context to understand where they're coming from, that they do have meaning, and that somehow it's all a woven pattern by a loving God. So I'm talking instead of you, but so what's this? This is hell business.
Yeah, well, you know, I think one of the very important things for me, and why I think God, you know, wanted me to go through those years, was that, you know, the personal circumstances are kind of almost not important, but I was going through, you know, a very, very difficult time. And, of course, if God isn't there, or if you can't recognize that God might be there, then you are in hell. You know, you really are. And I quickly saw the flip side of that when I converted, you know, years later, and I would pray after communion. I got the same sense of this is heaven, in the sense that, you know, you can't know the full reality, but you get this tiny glimpse of what heaven might mean. And to me, that's why I know that there's a hell, and I know that there's a heaven, because I have had these tiny intimations of what it would be like to be in hell or to be in heaven. So to me, they're very, very real. It's almost like a continuum. You know, after you die, you're kind of, you're in that place where there is no God, or, you know, you're traveling towards him, or you're very near to him.
Yeah, so you're held in an embrace of love with him.
Yeah, exactly.
If everything goes right.
Yeah, and I think
go ahead.
Well, no, I think people, you know, because it's funny, because actually tomorrow morning I start teaching catechism, so I'd like to ask everybody listening to say a little prayer for me, because I'm teaching 8-year-olds, and I already had a mother stop me in the street and say, you know, what will you say to them about hell? You know, you won't tell them there's a hell, surely, you know. And you know, it's such a shame that people can't recognize that of course there's hell, and there's nothing wrong with children knowing that, because it's so easy to escape from hell. You know, it's so easy to run towards God. and hell is such a reality.
Yeah. So what happened? What ruined this nice atheist British girl?
Yeah, well, it was a strange thing. I mean, I was 39, and I was a mother and married and living near Rome. And I'd published a couple of books of poetry, but I was actually beginning a project with a doctor in London who I'd worked with, because I used to be a nurse a long time ago. And we were writing a book about women's sexuality. And it was supposed to be very edgy and cover everything under the sun. Contraception, abortion, sex, the whole lot. And she was going to do the physiology, and I was going to do the social, cultural, historical aspect and talk to lots of different women. And to kind of put this in context, we live very near to Rome, and my daughter had just begun preschool at a convent-run school. And I'd chosen this convent-run school because it was the best school in town. So despite the fact it was Catholic, you know, I just wanted my daughter to be happy, and people had said, it's such a nice school. So she was going there. But at the same time, this was 2010, and that was when the sexual abuse stories were coming out about the church, in buckets. And it was really disturbing. I hated the church. Never more had I hated the church. And as part of my research for this book about women, I wanted to interview a Muslim woman and a Catholic woman and a lesbian woman and a prostitute and, the whole kind of cross-section of women. And I could find non-religious women to talk to very, very easily. But when I came to talk to religious women, they didn't want to talk to me. I still have got some very, very good Catholic friends, and these were American Catholics living near Rome, and our children played together. And when I said to them, can I talk to you about, sexuality, they would just, no, they wouldn't, which I found very frustrating. And I thought, I'll find a nun to talk to. I'll push it further. I'll get a nun, because Rome is full of nuns. But I didn't know how to find a nun. But I knew a priest through a friend of mine, this girl, Christina, who now lives in Boston. And this priest was about my age, and everyone said he was really nice and really funny. And I thought, he's probably just human. He probably knows deep down that the church is vile. I don't know. So I got his email address, and I wrote to him, and I said, I'm writing a book about women's sexuality, and could you find me a nun to talk to? Or what's the best way to go about it? And he wrote back, and he said he'd need to think about it. But then because he was, he was friendly and very human. And I suddenly thought, if he is funny and if he is human and if he is intelligent, which he obviously is, then I need to know, what he's doing. Why is he belonging to this church that's just disgusting? And I just thought, perhaps now's my chance to ask somebody all the questions I've always wanted to ask. It'd be like talking to somebody in the Nazi party, just... And so I wrote to him and I said, well, while you're thinking it over, can I just ask you some questions? And he said yes. And then I really began, battering him with emails. My big thing was, if you were banking and you discovered that your bank had got links to the mafia, wouldn't you just change banks? So now you know about all this abuse in the Catholic Church. Why don't you just change churches? And how can you belong to an institution that denies women equal rights, because women can't be priests. The list went on and on and on. And what surprised me was that he argued back quite vociferously. And we argued and argued and argued by email for quite a long time. We had a cup of tea at one point, which was, basically okay. And we managed to be civil to each other, but we were really fighting quite a lot by email. And then I think at a certain point, he almost got tired of it and he almost kind of withdrew. And I realized that something else was happening quite apart from the arguments, because he wasn't convincing me. I have to say, whatever he was saying, and I don't remember much of it now, it didn't convince me at an intellectual level. But there was something that was happening in my head, and I was becoming more and more sort of disturbed and upset, and I couldn't really figure out why. And I wasn't sleeping, and And I it's really, of course, it's impossible to explain because I think it's something very supernatural. And I had terrible insomnia, really, really bad insomnia. And after a while, I had the first kind of experience, which was the most almost low-key experience that I had, but it was incredibly important. I was reading something and I suddenly had this this insight into the fact that there could be a God. And I, you know, I don't know how to explain that, but you've got to understand that I had already interrogated myself and done lots of reading and read about atheism and read about religion, and I had never seen it, that it was possible that there could be a God. And I suddenly saw that there could be, and I just remember this incredible feeling of possibility and potential. Really odd, really, really odd. It really kind of took the lid off my head. It was amazing, and that was the first kind of step towards my conversion. But I think what's most interesting is that although I could see that there was a God, I had no peace because it was a faceless God. It was a God without attribute. I had no way of knowing if it was a good God. You know, why would it be a good God? You know, because there was still so much suffering in the world. I had no theological background. I was not catechized. You know, I still didn't believe in Jesus Christ as Son of God. So I had no peace. I could just see that there was something, and it was something I had to pursue. Yeah.
So?
You have to ask me the next question.
How did you pursue it?
Well, yeah, a lot of not sleeping and a lot of
I'll make it easy. I'll just give you a little list of maybes. One is perhaps your good Catholic friends and your interactions with them. Another is perhaps your feeding.
Okay. Well, at that point, this is why I think, you know, it's a very supernatural story. It's actually very interior, because at that point, no, the friends know. And Christina, my good friend, I did tell her, but she was brilliant. You know, I mean, she's a feisty one and she's an arguer and she's a debater. But when I told her, she wouldn't talk about it. She just said, she said, this isn't for me to talk about. You've got a lot of thinking to do. And she said, as long as you're talking to a good priest, then that's it. And she was so right to do that. Because I can tell you, and this is for everybody listening, you know, trying to persuade people, for me, it would never have worked. You know, someone sitting you down and saying, oh, Sally, you know, now you believe in God. Let me show you the catechism. Let me try and get you into the church. There's no way I would have reacted in a good way. You know, so it was nothing to do with that. It was nothing to do with anything human. And ditto the priest, Father Gregory, he just said, no one can convert you but Christ. He never tried to convert me. You know, and I think I really admire their faith, because there was no sense that they were trying to do it. They truly believed that Christ would do it.
So that attitude of theirs, their confidence in the Holy Spirit or in Christ, was that in itself kind of, I don't want to say convincing to you, but made you think, wow, they must really believe this or something?
Well, not at a conscious level. No, I don't know what I thought. I was glad that they were not trying to kind of, you know, sort of twist my arm. I think that was very wise of them, but not at a conscious level at all. I was just glad to kind of be left alone. And I did meet with Father Gregory, but we talked. We still argued, because I thought to myself, you know, even if I end up becoming a Christian, there's no way in 1,000 years I'll be a Catholic. So I was still arguing with him about Catholic doctrine. And we would just laugh and, you know, talk, and he was sympathetic, and I would, you know, pull my hair out, and I was having trouble, you know, sorting out my thoughts. And there were many kind of, well, many at that point, there were a couple of events which I can only describe as sort of mystical experiences. And the one that really, that settled everything to an extent was, well, it settled everything was I was going into this little, Carmelite church near my daughter's school every day. And I wasn't praying, because I'd never prayed and I didn't know how to pray. And I would just go and sit in this church and just try and think. And And one day I was in there and very kind of upset and my thoughts were very, you know, unclear, and I was very sort of in anguish, really. And I was crying, and I looked up, and there was this stained glass window of Christ's face. And I said aloud, if you're there, you have to help me. And there was this experience of almost being lifted up. I mean, physically, my tears just completely stopped. I felt this incredible presence. I mean, incredible, just so real, so real. And I knew it was Christ. There was no question in my mind at all. And it was the turning point of everything.
Wow.
Absolutely. And then from that point, I prayed the Our Father and knew that I was a Christian. And then it was the question of, well, which church do I belong to? Of course. And you know, I was even, well, you know, do I have to belong to a church? Because I was, you know, at that point as well, praying, my prayer life was so incredibly intense. You know, just this presence, you know, like nothing you can imagine. You know, the consolations and graces of those first sort of weeks, it was so incredible that I almost thought, well, do I have to go to church? Surely it's not even necessary. And then there's the piece in Matthew about praying alone in secret, right? And I thought, well, you know, that'll do me. But something kind of drove me. I just kept thinking, there's something else. There's something else. And I thought about joining the Anglican Church in Rome. I thought about joining the Quakers. Lots of different things. But I realized I had lots of reading to do. And so the summer of 2010, I started reading. And I read, I didn't want to read anything about something. I wanted to read the original texts. So I read the Gospels, and I read, you know, St. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas, you know, the absolute, even though it was hard. I mean, Thomas Aquinas was, you know, incredibly hard. I wanted to read stuff that was absolutely from the fundament of the church. And so at the beginning of that summer, I was still very kind of anti-Catholic. But by the end of the summer, I realized, almost, you know, again, no one told me this. I didn't, I knew about the Eucharist and I knew about transubstantiation, and I believed it. I could see that that was the case. It was really odd. I just knew that was the case. And I didn't yet know about the tabernacle and the host being in the tabernacle. It sounds crazy, but I, you know, why would I know? But I kind of knew that there was something in Catholic churches that wasn't in any other church. And I just knew I had to get close to it. And so by the end of that summer, I just knew that if I wanted to be close to Christ, I had to be Catholic. There was just no other way. Because to me, this is the way I am. I'm completely Eucharistic. I have to be close to Christ. Mm-hmm. And to me, the greatest gift that we have is communion. And, to, you know, just the idea of going to a church where that wasn't there, I would find that, you know, very difficult.
At what point, this may be an unanswerable question, but at what point did you make the connection between the Eucharist and the real presence of Christ?
Well, I think it was that summer when I was in London, actually, and I was looking for a church to go to, and I knew it had to be a Catholic church. So it sounds kind of strange, because I didn't know about the tabernacle, but I knew I could sense this presence in a Catholic church. It's hard to remember, actually, when I figured out that the real presence.
Well, let me ask it a different way then, which is, how come you weren't dying to receive the Eucharist if you made that equation, had already made that equation? Wouldn't you want to receive communion?
Yeah, I did. It slid over to that very quickly, because I was already making a spiritual communion that summer. So, yeah, quickly it became like, you know, I have to receive. And that was why I was in such a hurry to convert, because I emailed the priest in the March of 2010, mm-hmm. and by December I was a Catholic. In December I became Catholic. So you see, it was very quick, and the rush for me was that I really wanted to receive communion. I just couldn't bear to be at the Mass any longer and not be able to do that.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's the other thing, you know, teaching. Sorry, go on.
Go ahead.
Teaching catechism. Oh, you broke up slightly. What did you say?
I said it's your show. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, you know, teaching catechism, which is on my my mind, as you can tell, you know, because I'm teaching Italian children, because I still live near Rome. You know, I want to be able to tell them, you know, because to them, there are Catholic churches everywhere, and they just, they do kind of take it for granted. And, you know, it's not to be taken for granted. Because, you know, I grew up in a country where the churches are mostly Protestant, and there's a very different vibe walking into a Protestant church. There really is.
Yeah. I'll just give you a little break, because your story reminded me in many ways of things that happened in mine. And I also was driven to the Catholic Church by a desire to receive communion. And at the time, I actually didn't believe much of Catholic dogma. You know, I think I came from a background in some sense like yours, and, you know, I didn't believe in hell. I didn't believe in all the severity. I didn't believe in sexual sin, actually. You know, all that old-fashioned medieval stuff I didn't believe in, but I wanted to receive communion. And the first time I knew you had to be baptized in order to receive communion. So the first time I asked a priest to baptize me, he said, he was a monk. So he, I don't want to say therefore he was very holy, but he was very holy. And, he said, why did you want to see me? I said, I want to be baptized. And he said, why do you want to be baptized? And I decided to tell him the truth. I said, I want to be baptized because I want to receive communion, and you guys won't let me unless I'm baptized. And I thought he'd get angry and throw me out, you know, for being just so disrespectful and not believing in the Catholic Church or anything. And instead, he just nodded and said, aha, that's the Holy Spirit at work.
Yeah. So, and this is the thing, I think, you know, that people overlook, is that the sacraments, you know, they're so important. They're so incredibly important. You know, they're God's way of reaching down to us. And I think the problem we have now is that we take them so much for granted.
Yeah, that's why I do what I do, is because that's the danger of being a cradle Catholic, is kind of being oblivious to the unique role of the Catholic Church, and that unique role is defined largely around the sacraments. Whenever I'm doing, I don't want to call it apologetics, but whenever, you know, I'm dealing with, you know, somebody who's Jewish or Protestant and is full of, I don't know if I'm allowed to say legitimate criticism of the Catholic Church, but certainly legitimate criticism of behavior of individuals who purport to represent the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And they say, like what people said to you, you know, sort of how can you root for this team, essentially? How can you align yourself, you know, with this institution where there's all this evil being done? What I always fall back on is the sacraments, because the sacraments are the supernatural mechanism which God provided for humanity to provide the greatest possible intimacy between God and man, between birth and death. It's very simple. And those sacraments require the apostolic succession. They require essentially the Catholic Church. The sacraments are kind of the bedrock. For me, they're the bedrock of apologetics for Catholicism.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think, you know, the Catholic Church, you know, is made up of human beings, as, you know, and people make mistakes and people do terrible things, but I'm always so glad that we have the Catholic Church, we have the magisterium, and we have tradition, because I think, we're very lucky to have that. I think religion goes awry when we get away from that, you know, when there aren't those things, those unchanging truths and that safeguarding. I think that's a big problem.
Yeah, there has to be authority in order to have that assured continuity. But since we're kind of talking about sacraments, I do like putting my guests on the spot, and I'm going to put you on the spot. Tell me, I guess I'll just go through them sort of one by one. First of all, I don't know enough about your history. Had you been baptized before you were brought into the Catholic Church?
Yeah, ironically I was, and I'll tell you why. Because in Britain, when I was born, it was still a country that was, a bit religious, and people had to be baptized to do things like go into teacher training. So my mum had wanted to be a teacher at one point, and she couldn't do it because she hadn't been baptized. So she vowed that she'd get us all baptized so we had all the right paperwork, and, she wanted to do the right thing. So, yes, I was baptized.
Okay. So I can't ask you about your experience of your baptism, since you don't remember it, presumably. Let me ask you about your experience of your first confession, then.
Yeah, that was always an interesting one. I found it. Yeah, I mean, it was wonderful. It was strange because, you know, how do you confess a lifetime of sin? It's all, you know, almost impossible. You have to just kind of say, you know, everything I've got, take everything I've got. But I think what really, really stunned me about my first confession was, you know, this incredible relief and this incredible mercy. You know, really, there were things, I'm sure that everybody has things in their life that are big, that they carry around with them with a certain amount of guilt and regret. And I felt just incredibly relieved once I'd confessed, and just so aware of God's love and so aware of the mercy of the church, you know, as an instrument of God. You know, it was really amazing. I think confession is something, you know, we all struggle with to some degree, and I think it can vary so much with the confessor, but it's good to remember that first occasion when I was just so aware of God's incredible mercy.
Did you cry?
No, I didn't cry, strangely enough, no. No. And I think, you know, part of that was I was very prepared for it, and I had talked over some of the issues with the priest that was converting me, and I didn't confess to him because he wanted me to go to somebody else that I didn't know at all and just kind of have a different experience with, you know, just with as mostly happens, you tend to go to people that you don't know as friends because, you know.
Especially if you really have something to confess.
I'd kind of like kind of been through stuff in my head already, and I didn't cry. I felt kind of, I don't know. I think I kind of hurried through it, really, I think is the answer, which is very poetic. I hurried through it. And he told me to read some very, very good books, which were absolutely the right things to tell me to read. And, yeah, I still think about that confession. If you get a wise confessor, you remember things that they say for a very long time.
Yes, and ideally it's the Holy Spirit speaking through the confessor. So they may not, they may be wiser than they know, so to speak.
Yeah.
What about the first time you had the infinite privilege of receiving the Eucharist?
Yeah, that was amazing, really. I mean, it felt like a continuation of the experience that I'd had in the Carmelite church when I felt this presence kind of come down. And it felt, you know, and it still does actually often feel like a real embrace. It's something so physical. You know, that's what I remember that first time very much as kind of stillness and kind of an embrace. And still then, but today, you know, reflecting on experiences with communion, I sometimes want to ask other Catholics about this. And perhaps a radio show is not the right time or place. But, you know, I just wondered, you know, I find it very physical. It's so, it never ceases to amaze me. I mean, not every time, but it's something that affects your heart, you know, your blood. It's everything, isn't it? So, yeah. I suppose it's different for everybody. I'm a very physical person. You know, I somatize. I feel things in my body very easily. So I think God reaches me in a very physical way.
The radio, neither is the radio a place to play spiritual director, but it is not uncommon for this sounds kind of creepy, but you know, all of life is a progressive you know, growing together with God, and there are stages on that progression which are consistent with spiritual consolation and a very immediate sense of the presence of God and consolation with the Eucharist and so forth. And you also have this dreaded, like, dark night of the soul. I think yesterday was the feast day of St. Teresa of Avila, right? So I guess really what I'm saying is that over the course of your life, God will lead you through different stages, and it probably won't always be this experience.
Yeah, no, I guess that.
Because I mean, well, I'm a convert too, and I would say the hardest part wasn't losing that honeymoon period. The hardest part was misinterpreting the loss of that honeymoon period, to think that I had done something wrong and been rejected by God or something like that. That's actually what made it hard. That was much harder than simply the absence of the intense spiritual consolation. Sure, you have real spiritual directors to talk to. Let me read a quote from Herman Cohen, who is a Jewish convert, a hero of mine. His story is in Honey from the Rock, which is another book I wrote of witness testimonies. But anyway, he had for all his life, he had after his conversion, he had tremendous spiritual consolation from the Eucharist. And so I'll just read two sentences from his hymn. Oh, Jesus, my love, no greater happiness can exist than that which I experience in loving you in the Eucharist and in receiving you in my poor heart, so rich because of you. What delicious peace, what happiness, what holy joy. And yes, I won't look for these other quotes from other converts, but I think it is a particular, I don't want to say a gift of being a convert, but it's something that is much more typical when people either have a reversion to the faith or a conversion to the faith to receive such sensible consolation from the Eucharist.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I read there's a wonderful book called I Love Jesus in the Night about Mother Teresa, and it's shocking to learn that her dark night lasted for, I think I'm right in saying, something like 30 years. You know, she had incredible sort of mystical and consoling experiences at the very beginning, and then nothing, absolutely nothing. She had no sense of the presence at all. And there's even a story in that book, which is written by Father Paul Murray, about her in adoration with all of her nuns. And she wrote something on a piece of paper and kind of sent it up to the priest at the front. And on the piece of paper was just written, "Where is Jesus?" You know, she just felt this incredible absence. And it was almost a secret until after she died. And so she had incredible faith because she didn't have those, those mystical experiences through most of her life.
Yeah. Thérèse of Lisieux had a lot of consolation in prayer, and she consciously and willingly offered it up to God and said, basically, take it away from me and use it for the conversion of people who don't know you.
Yeah.
So then her last years were in a complete absence of a sensible awareness of God, because she had consciously given it up for the conversion of others.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess we have to be prepared for the dark night. Hey.
yes, but we also have to, I mean, the key thing, is, so to speak, is to not misinterpret it. Because that's the other thing. The devil is always there, whispering in your ear, oh, this is because you blew it or whatever, and, or you were imagining all of that or anything else.
Yeah.
But since you're on the spot already, I'll keep you on the spot a little bit. I would imagine that you also, at least at times, have sensible technical term for it is consolation. In other words, feelings of love, feelings of peace, feelings of being loved, feelings of embrace, in the presence of exposition of the Blessed Sacrament.
Yeah. In fact, I was very, very lucky because recently, it was actually in 2013, the nuns at the convent where my daughter is at school set up adoration on a Thursday, and I kind of did it with them. We kind of organized it together, and so every Thursday I spent at least a couple of hours in adoration, and really I miss it so much. I was thinking recently how much I miss it, and I think it's a strange thing because you're adoring Christ, right? And yet looking back it feels like I was experiencing so much of the Father. It's really odd. It feels like God communicated so much to me as I was there. I should add, I mean, there was a reason behind this. I was translating the diary of the Blessed Maria Crocifissa Curcio, who's a beatified nun who was the founder of my daughter's school. And she loved the Eucharist. She was crazy for the Eucharist. You know, she would get up in the middle of the night to go and sit by the tabernacle. And she was a mystic. And I translated her diary, and the nun who asked me to do it kind of set up adoration to, I think, kind of almost revive that contemplative mystical aspect in the congregation. And so I was involved in that work, and I was adoring Christ, and under the altar, this blessed nun, her incorrupt body is in a glass coffin. So it was very intense. You know, it was really, really odd, because I could pray, you know, with her and for her, and we both prayed to Christ. And you know, it was a really, really strange and lovely, lovely time.
Wow.
And I miss the adoration, because it's actually stopped, because the nuns have kind of had a reorganization and they're adoring alone in their congregation. And so the public aren't in it so much. And I miss that very much indeed.
And there's no way to establish any to lobby for some kind of public exposition.
Yeah, I think that there is. It's just always a question because of, you know, with work and being a mum. Mm-hmm. I go to Mass every morning, and that's actually happened in the last 18 months that I go to Mass every morning, which is fantastic. I'm very pleased to be able to do that. And I need to kind of get in some adoration there as well at the same time.
Yeah. Well,
but I've got to work.
I'll have one last putting you on the spot, because of course this is Radio Maria, and I am sure there's a little story of your I hate the word, but journey with Mary, your relationship with Mary.
Yeah, well, it's really odd, because and I write about this in my book as well, because Mary is somebody who's accompanied me really oddly all the way through my life, because I've always been obsessed with paintings and images of the Madonna, always. It's been a constant theme through my life. I've been very, very attracted to, you know, it's hard to say what it was. I wondered if it was Renaissance art, then I thought it was Byzantine art, and, you know, I could never really understand. But I was very kind of just fascinated by her face. And then I thought she was just a victim of the patriarchal church, because she was this silenced woman. And I wrote about Mary as a poet. I wrote poems about the Annunciation. And there was a lot of Madonna-type imagery in my poetry. And yet, through those months of conversion, she was very silent. I wasn't really conscious of Mary. I was so taken up with Christ. You know, I didn't really think about Mary much. And then when I started to pray the rosary, sort of later on in that year, I began to walk with her, and I realized that she'd been a presence in my life, you know, right from the beginning, long before I converted. I realized that kind of constant devotion that I had to art, for years as a woman in my 20s, I had a picture of the Madonna in my room, which, you know, is astounding for an atheist, and my parents could not understand it. They thought it was really odd. And I had no explanation for it. I just found her a very comforting presence. And I think that she really kind of led me by the hand and watched over me. And I think things could have gone much, much worse as an atheist than they did. And I suspect that I was, you know, being protected in some measure by her.
No doubt. And what about the role of Mary in your spirituality now, and the role of the rosary?
Yeah, well, I pray the rosary every day, and it's a discipline. I think it's so important, because it keeps you focused, and again it really symbolizes the church in general, that, you know, without these prayers and without these things, we risk drifting into particular areas or focusing on something at the expense of something else. And the rosary is just such a good grounding on going through the mysteries and going through everything in a balanced way. I find it just very, very grounding. Extremely grounding, and it's so powerful. It has such results. Oh my goodness, the untire of knots. Don't get me started. seriously, you know, it's amazing.
So what's the untire of knots? I'm getting you started.
I know. Well, this is the devotion that Francis is particularly fond of, and well, gosh, I can't remember the whole story in detail, but it surrounds a picture that was painted hundreds of years ago of Mary untying knots in long ribbons. And the idea is that she's untying the knots in our lives. And it particularly relates to marriages and difficulties in marriages, but it doesn't have to be marriages. And you do a novena, a 9-day novena, and each day you focus on Mary untying the knot that you give her. And, you know, really, it's the most astonishing results. Actually, you know, the last one I did was lovely because it was a particular thing I was very, very worried about. And I prayed the novena and I didn't really feel any different. And it was around, I think it was in March, and on the Feast of the Annunciation, I suddenly was like, wow, it went, you know, it had just gone. And it's very powerful because it requires lots of meditation and focus and trust. It's really about handing your life over.
Well, you were concerned about filling an hour, but unfortunately we've done so, or come very close. So first of all, let me, I'll let you take a little bit of a breather, and I don't want to say plug your book, but recommend your book, which was supposed to come out, what, in about a year from now, late 2016? When's the
book? Yes, the fall 2016.
Fall is 2016 from Ignatius Press, which is, of course, also the publisher of John Paul II and Benedict and Pope Francis and so forth. So, the author's name, who we've been speaking with today, is Sally Reed, R-E-A-D. And the current title of the book, which may or may not remain the title once it is published, is A Deep and Dazzling Darkness. But that title might be changed in between now and the publication date, so it would be safer to look for the author, who is Sally Reed, R-E-A-D, from Ignatius Press. And do you have any final words of wisdom for our audience?
I wouldn't be so arrogant. No, wisdom, I think I'm lacking. But I hope that as a convert, you know, because, you know, I'm new to it all. I really am new. And I think the only reason I wrote the book was because I felt God wanted me to. I felt it was the right thing to do, and was to convey the passion and to convey the love. And if I can infect or inspire someone to go to Christ, then it's worth it.
I thank you. That's why I had you on, or at least just to take the possibility seriously, the possibility of Jesus seriously, and the possibility of the Catholic Church and its sacraments seriously, and to look at the right side of the coin and not the wrong side of the coin, which I think is part of your story, that you can always find lots of things to quibble with and object to, coming from the human participation in the church. But there's also the other side, which is the side that is the direct link to God, like doesn't exist between birth and death from any other source. So I didn't mean to put words in your mouth, but anyway, so thank you very much for being on the show. I want to thank our listeners for listening. I want you to invite you to listen again next week to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, on Radio Maria. And perhaps when it comes out, you might want to give, I'm sorry, this is not the first time or the last time, Sally Reed's book a read when it comes out next fall. So anyway, thank you for listening, and thank you very much, Sally, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And that's it for today, so please join us again next week for Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism. Bye for now.